And welcome to the consumerization of enterprises. We're going to be talking about generally B2B trends, specifically with SaaS and enterprise software. So just to give you guys a bit of an introduction, so my name is Zhao. It's pronounced like wow, except it was a Z. And it's always a good one. I'm one of the co-founders of BetterWorks. We play in the rewards and recognition space. I previously created two products. One was called My Mini Life, which was an embeddable virtual world. And then in the middle, we asked a lot of the users, you know, why they weren't coming back, and they told us that it was really boring. And then from that feedback, we decided to create a farm game. We sold it to Zynga in 2009. And now we're basically creating BetterWorks.
Yeah, so I'm George Ishii. I'm head of design and co-founder. Of BetterWorks, and my background is mostly in consumer and a little bit of enterprise software. I have a software engineering background. I worked at Adobe for a few years out of college, and went through PayPal as an engineer and front-end designer and UX person. Went through all of the fun PayPal stuff, and then went to co-found Genie.com, which is building the world's family tree, and Yammer actually spun off from Genie.com as an internal tool that was called Workfeed before it was called Yammer. Yammer's doing pretty well now, and now head of design at BetterWorks. Zhao and I are co-founders, and our third co-founder is Paige Craig right there in the front row.
So we're going to talk about a couple things, you know. We're going to take you through kind of about the traditional challenges of enterprise software. So one bit, I didn't mention or highlight is I used to work at IBM on enterprise content management software for pharmaceuticals and finance vertical. that was a fun experience. And I'll kind of go into the traditional challenges of enterprise software, the impact of consumer internet, and you know why that has caused a dramatic shift in expectations. And then we're going to talk about best practices within the current B2B space. So when you think of enterprise software, you know, you think of, I hope this doesn't offend anyone, but when you think of big monolithic software, you know, typically multi-million dollars, you have an army, and I mean an army of consultants implementing it, and it usually takes the implementation time takes, you know, 3 to 5 months, and plus the total cost of ownership is in the multi millions of dollars, and but you know now it's starting to shift, and I wanted to go into a little bit on why it's shifting. The historical challenges of everything. You know, many of the logos on the right side you can probably identify with. You know, there's Box, there's 37 Signals, there's Wufoo, there's Google Docs, and let me kind of you know take you back in the Wayback Machine. Way back in the day there was. A lot of mainframes and mini computers way back, and when people developed software, they were primarily for a couple of verticals. There's a financial, there's accounting, there's HR, there's variety of verticals, and you typically have a army of consultants implementing the entire thing. You know, they would typically get a series of requirements. They would take a look at the entire kind of a enterprise organization, and it would cost a ton of money. And the reason why it costs a ton of money is there were no other kind of a distribution mechanisms. The only people that would actually be able to pay for it would be the enterprise guys. Small medium business software on the B2B space was simply unheard of until you had Intuit and a lot of other companies. And a lot of the mechanism for distribution of the software was simply not there. And that's why you had to have a massive, massive sales force, plus a lot of consultants helping to implement it. And because a lot of the distribution mechanisms were not there, you had a very, very high price point, because that's the only way you can actually sustain a company. And the other problem is it was very, very decision maker focused. So the person that actually made the decision would literally buy the software by checking off a checklist. If you had connections to LDAP, if you have connections to Active Directory or kind of a VPN and different security requirements, and you looked at the other enterprise software, you would win or die based on that. And so what you end up having is just completely non-functional user interfaces, because it really didn't matter. Who cares if the end user has to suffer through the workflow? And so in kind of the 90s as well as, but mostly in kind of starting in 2003, 2004, you start to have the rise of consumer internet. And there's a combination of different companies that help facilitate that. All the usual ones that you can think of, the Yelps of the world, the Facebooks of the world. And the thing with consumer internet is it has to instantaneously work. Because consumers are very fickle, you land on a registration page and you want to have instantaneous value. You get a different, totally different set of expectations from consumer internet.
So cool. Yeah. So thanks, Sal. Basically, what I want to do now is take some of these ideas and make them more relevant to you by sharing five best practices for designing for a consumer enterprise. And I apologize, I'm a designer, so it's going to be slightly from a design standpoint, but we all know that design in the product is everything, right? By show of hands, do we have any designers here, by the way? Yes. Yes. Engineers? Yes. Entrepreneurs? Should be everybody. Marketing and business. Good. Awesome. How many of you type on your iPhone with two fingers? One finger? Okay. I think there's some kind of correlation between engineers and typing, or business people and BlackBerry users and typing on your iPhone. Anyway. So back to five best practices for the consumer enterprise. And basically what my hope is that you guys could take something home with you from this talk that's really going to help you design better software and make you more successful in whatever you're trying to do. And, you could please ask questions afterwards if we don't cover any of these things, because it's really, you can ask anybody. I'm very passionate about helping people out and helping other people find success in what they're trying to do. So without further ado, let's go through some of the best practices. So the first is instant gratification, and you could bring instant gratification to your users through the first-time user experience. How many of you have heard about first-time user experience, the term? Good. Cool. So basically, this is the opportunity for you to put your product in front of your users very quickly and have their undivided attention, and it really is your opportunity to hook them into the product and establish and promote and communicate value to them. And the idea is when you're designing your experience, design it so that it promotes activities that create value immediately. And so how many use Yammer here? So if you could think back to the very first time, the first time you use experience with Yammer, one of the things that happens is it drops you into the feed and there's a big giant box that says, what are you working on, right? You type something in, you click the button, and all of a sudden it gets published to the feed. Other people see it, they respond to it, they might actually type in what they're working on, and you could see how this is creating this snowball effect. And what this is communicating to both individual employees and managers is that we have a very valuable product, because now it's about collaboration in the workplace. Now it's something that our company and our employees created. So that's an example of creating value very, very quickly during the first-time user experience. A couple questions I like to ask myself when designing first-time experience is, number one, what's the goal? And number two, how can I educate the user, right? So the goal is easy. It's the task that will bring the user the most success. And that could be uploading a file. That could be like in Dropbox or Box.net. It could be creating content with Yammer or 37 Signals. It could be making a purchase, like what we try to do with Betterworks. But the important thing is that you define what this goal is, and then you try to measure its success, right? And you do that by breaking it up into very sort of discrete steps and then measuring against each one of those steps. And you guys are probably familiar with products out there that do this very specifically. Google Analytics, we use Mixpanel. There's also Kissmetrics. And what those actually do is create what's called a conversion funnel, which allows you to see step by step where the most drop-off is happening. And the reason why that's important is because you assess where the biggest drop-off is and you focus your resources to fixing that, because that represents the biggest opportunity for improvement. Educating the user, that's sort of more about creating some sort of guided tour the first time they come to your site. Sometimes it's in the form of maybe a video or maybe some sort of interactive guided tour. This is an example of a mixed panel funnel. You could see how with each step it shows the drop off, the last step being that goal that I'm talking about. And this is an example of a sort of an educational interactive thing where it's essentially pointing out the three top functions of this site. And you don't want to do too many. You probably want to do two or three. But these, again, are things that are going to create early success for the user. Let's talk about the second best practice. Focus on smaller work groups. And the idea here is to empower managers of smaller groups within a larger organization to adopt your product at a local level. Okay? So this is effective because typically, distribution and adoption, which is actually really hard, even if you have a really good product, it's much easier within a smaller group, right? You guys know each other. There's a greater sense of trust amongst a smaller group or team. This should not even be called a group. It's called a team, right? Because it's smaller and there's trust. And there's also a higher level of accountability. The manager is right there. He's telling you to use this, as well as you have coworkers who are saying, hey, how come you're not using this, right? So there's more accountability. The lower price point actually makes it easier to manage financially. It's not this huge financial matter. And the idea here is you also want to craft a first-time user experience for the manager. If it's the manager who's testing this out and making the decision, perhaps you want to create a registration process where you get the manager in there initially, just as a solo person, have him test out and try before he buys, and assess whether there's value there. The other thing you could do is you could create an experience where a smaller test group goes in and sort of as a committee could decide how valuable the product is.
So I wanted to talk about kind of about the work group a little bit. This is very, very crucial because traditionally when you're talking about decision makers within enterprise software, you're basically talking about the CIOs, the CTOs of the world. And work group products as a kind of a concept is specifically focused on the managers, cross-functional groups. And the reason why that's important is is virality and a lot of kind of a distribution mechanism come from the workgroup product. Because of the lower price point, because you can actually discover it through the web, the workgroup product actually is the unit of measurement. It's designed for the manager, so a lot of your marketing, a lot of your messaging, a lot of your feature set is actually designed for the workgroup. Just to kind of give you an example, Atlassian products, so commonly known as Jira, as well as there's other kind of a wiki-based products, if you deploy it into an enterprise, it will literally not scale. And so you would think, you know, Atlassian products, and you know, if you deploy it to 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 users, that they would kind of you know, they wouldn't have any problem. But because they so designed it for a group of, you know, 10, 30 kind of people, a lot of their features in the back end doesn't scale. And you know, I'm illustrating kind of an extreme example, but this is actually the reason why it's succeeded. It's focused on the managers, it's focused on feature-rich functionality, it's not focused on the CIOs or CTOs. So.
Thanks, that's a great point. And we're also seeing that what happens, furthermore, once this product starts succeeding in smaller teams, it'll start to move across the organization and grow out sort of from the inside out. Next best practice is design matters. This is a screenshot of an actual website. You could go to it. It's called lingscars.com. And it's pretty well known. It's a dealership in the UK. And it's pretty well known as one of the worst designed websites in the world. And this is not even the worst of it, because you could actually scroll for about 20 minutes and it keeps going and keeps going and keeps going. And don't all go to it right now, though, because it's so big that we'll probably take down the network. And so at many points in this, I feel like Ling is shouting at me, and it's not a very friendly website, right? So I'm going to talk a little bit about friendly websites. So Zal just mentioned Atlassian right here. These are screenshots of real enterprise workplace software. And the age of sort of boring interfaces is going away, and we're welcoming in sort of a new personal, sort of fun sort of visual design sensibility. And so even the workplace, there's nothing wrong with having fun, especially when that fun leads to happier, healthier, more engaged, and more productive employees. One of the things that we constantly hear a bit of feedback is that people are pretty it's refreshing to see this type of website in the workplace alongside some of what they're used to seeing. And it makes this sort of fun, informal aspect makes them want to come back and makes them want to use our product inside.
I want to kind of dive a little bit more. I mean, it's design is not just about kind of being pretty. It's about information architecture. It's about how your eyes navigate throughout the entire site, and it's about kind of reducing cognitive load when you're actually looking at the site. A lot of people, you know, some non-designers were like, you know, why is there kind of the advent of gradients, you know, linear gradients, kind of radial gradients, and the reason why is it's information architecture. It looks like that it actually pops on the site. And you know, why is everything rounded? Because when you look at sharp corners, your brain actually has much more kind of cognitive load, because you know your brain is actually designed for physical spaces. So the fact that you see a sharp edge, mm-hmm. You actually think you see it as dangerous. So a lot of those very commonly known information architectural practices are basically coming in into the workplace, and primarily this goes back to the workgroup product. Basically, mm-hmm. if you're pulling out your personal credit card to actually make yourself productive, so the decision makers is merging to kind of the end user. If I'm kind of a small dev manager and then I want to use Jira or kind of a certain Atlassian product, then I want to kind of I want to not only pull out and actually make my team productive, but I want it to be actually functional and easy to use. So you know, the emphasis is design is not just prettiness, it's actually how it behaves and actually works.
Yeah, that's a great point. Steve Jobs likes rounded corners, by the way, if you read his biography. So, yeah, that's a great point. That's a really good point. The progressively younger workforce is not sitting in front of the TV for 6 hours anymore. They're on Facebook, they're tweeting, they're being addicted to Pinterest or whatever the next big thing is. And Zhao has a really good point about bringing, sort of building that bridge across from consumer software that your employees or that employees, your customers are using, and bringing that into the workplace. And ideally, the very first time someone uses your app in the workplace, it would be fantastic if it's already familiar to them and they already know how to use it. That's what we're really aiming for. So the next best practice, try before you buy, or what we're calling use before you buy. And really, we have a fantastic opportunity right now because it's now possible to put workplace solutions and workplace products in the hands of employees, in the hands of workplace managers. And the interesting thing about this is that these are the very people who are looking for solutions to workplace problems. They're trying to squeeze out productivity improvements out of their day. And so these people are typically aren't necessarily looking for long, they're not shopping for long feature lists. Instead, they're looking for very focused solutions. So the best practice would be to solve for a very specific problem instead of going for a long, long feature list. In fact, there is an MIT study that concluded that users would tend toward longer feature lists for software that they couldn't try before they bought, but then they would tend towards shorter feature lists for software that they could actually try. So for the use before you buy, it's best to focus on a very specific solution and do it very, very well. Again, focus that experience towards activities that will bring immediate value, because once you could sort of consistently create value for the user or for the decision maker, and once they've earned your trust, that's a great time to ask them to upgrade and pay for your product. Essentially, what we're doing is we're bringing the tail end of the traditional sales process into the product and letting the decision be made while immersed in the product and after value's been communicated. The last best practice, incentivize distribution. Now, adoption of enterprise software, as probably most of you know, is actually really, really hard. It's a real problem, especially when it's done from the top down, right? So a software deployment gets deployed across 10,000 employees, and it gets pushed down on all of the employees. But how about sort of a distribution, smaller distribution through social channels inside the workplace, right? This is a fantastic opportunity, partly because sharing is just much more powerful amongst peers, amongst people who you work with, people who share the same challenges as you, people who might be a little bit closer to you on the org chart, right? And so a few best practices for incentivizing social distribution through the workplace. Number one, reward behavior by making their account more valuable, right? And so the good examples there are Dropbox and PayPal, right? How many of you guys use Dropbox? Like almost everybody, right? You guys know about the 500 megabyte, right? The 500 megabyte reward, right? And it really works, right? Whether you have the money to pay for it or not, it really, really works to incentivize you to share, right? We even had a battle as three co-founders in the very beginning to see who could get the most sharing space on Dropbox. And guess what? We're using Dropbox now across the entire company. PayPal, in the very beginning, I don't know if you guys knew this, but we used to give $10 for every account that you created through an invitation. We were burning through $1 million a month just in referrals in the early days. We moved it down to $5, and now it's nothing. But it goes to show you that this type of incentivization really, really works. In fact, it works. It's such a strong and powerful incentive that it's now a best practice to have a referral page where you go and it tracks the people that you've invited, and it shows where they are, right? Because basically what that page is these are all the people that I invited, and this is the free stuff that I got for them, right? And these are the people who haven't responded, and I didn't get my free stuff yet, right? And so actually really good designers will design nudges or re-invite functionality in mass on those pages so you could bug your friends even more and you could focus on the people who haven't done what you need to get done, right? So the second incentivization for social distribution in the workplace is you could actually use privacy as an incentive. So Harvard. So one of Facebook. One of the reasons why Facebook grew so quickly in the beginning was because there was a sense of security and camaraderie amongst Harvard students. Right? It's like they're family, right? And Facebook initially, they pioneered this fantastically simple but sophisticated interface. Do you remember the very first interface? How many went to Harvard? Anybody went to Harvard here? Did you use Facebook when it was just Harvard? Oh, okay. So they pioneered this interface which showed an open text box where you type in just what's in front of the @harvard.edu. And that it's so simple, but it's I love that because it makes it a lot easier and less painful to invite people because all you do, you don't have to type the full email address. But the other thing that it did is it reinforced this idea that of privacy, that this is only going to people that you knew who were part of your group.
I wanted to kind of go into that a little bit more. It's really important that privacy is inherently kind of built in, because the way most people kind of design things is they have a default open or default private, and essentially what Facebook as well as LinkedIn is they had a default somewhere in the middle, and what that allowed kind of everything to people to do is they felt inherently safe within the network. And I know there's a lot of hullabaloo about, you know, Facebook and the privacy issues and whatever it be, but it allows you to kind of have a default setting within your network and progressively disclose as you kind of felt more and more comfortable. So
yeah, that's a good point, thanks. And you know, we could bring the same sense of incentivization through privacy into the workplace because naturally we have a network of people who we work with, who we trust automatically, and who we share that sense of privacy and camaraderie with. Yammer does actually a good example of this where on the invite page, there's only 6 fields. So Yammer's not asking for you to upload your entire the entire company directory. They're saying invite the 6 closest coworkers that you know. In fact, even in their messaging, they say now invite a few of your coworkers. And there are 6 of them, and it actually extends to 7, 8, 9 as you type in, only as you type in the last one. So as you're typing the 6th, it shows a 7th and 8th and so on and so forth. So the initial loading of the page only shows 6 for that smaller, more intimate sense of security. Number 3 best practice for incentivizing distribution is make the distribution an integral part of the solution that you're offering to the user. So instead of creating an entirely separate invitation flow where this is kind of scary, we're going to invite you, just make it an integral part of the solution. So it's like, okay, well, I want to get some feedback from a logo design. Step number 1, upload the logo. Step number 2, specify those that you want to get feedback from. It doesn't feel like an invitation flow. It doesn't feel like a privacy thing. And all of these are great, but ultimately what it comes down to is engagement. That's really what is going to sort of perpetuate growth inside of your product inside of the organization. So finally, there to sum this all up, there's actually a pattern across these best practices, right? So we all prefer instant gratification. We all work in teams. We all respond well to good design, and we would all prefer to try before we commit to something. And so my point is that these are not only best practices, but they actually point to basic, fundamental, core human needs that that everybody has.
Yeah, and this is an important point, because certainly we're talking about kind of a consumerization of enterprises, and is it a natural trend? Is it not a natural trend? But the argument that we're basically making is these are fundamental to every single human being, and so if you as a kind of a person can increase your productivity through a lot of these work group products, then you will naturally gravitate more and more to these products, and that's kind of the core point. So, after talking about the best practices as well as the history, we basically think that there's a new category of applications, and it's starting to transform different verticals. Whether it's collaboration, whether it's project management, storage, HR, we're even inbound marketing. Both the price point, both the ease of use, everything is designed for smaller workgroup products. So in conclusion, all you have to do is to work with your coworkers on the internet. This is our contact information, and we're applying these best practices to BetterWorks, we're at the intersection of awards and recognition for small medium businesses. So,
thanks. So, wow, thanks. So it looks like we've got about 20 minutes left, and we wanted to have a conversation with you guys. I mean, this room is small enough. I feel like we don't even need mics, but the podcast people say we need mics. So there's actually a mic right in the middle, and we'd like to hear your questions. Like I said, we're definitely here to help. We're very passionate about helping people find success, and we want to hear some of the challenges that you guys are facing and ways that we could help you guys do that. So you could start forming a line behind the mic if you want. Have questions.
All right, I just have a question on you commented on the design a lot, but you didn't comment about the use of client versus the web and when you should have both. And I don't know if there's any general rules around that. Because, a lot of those examples have both. And how close should the design look similar between the two? Should they be very different? Should you use one for one purpose, one for the other, et cetera?
Yeah, the interesting thing about, what you're alluding to is that there's different types of the cloud. There's kind of the cloud, which is just pure website and on the internet, and then there's software plus services, which is essentially it's Apple's approach as well as Dropbox's approach. And I generally think for certain classes of applications, that's a better user experience. So if you think about how people interact with TweetDeck for Twitter, how people interact with there's actually a Yammer desktop application. When you're interacting with the desktop, there are certain things that you can do. You can have a very seamless experience. You don't have to log in. You don't have to open your browser. So it actually removes a lot of steps from the entire process. So it just highly depends on kind of about the application. I definitely think for certain classes of application, software plus services is actually better than just pure services and cloud. And it highly depends. So,
So I have a question about data, in that you mentioned a bunch of interesting design choices. So, for example, with Yammer, the decision to only sort of prompt for six people and so forth. Do you know any data off the top of your head in terms of the effectiveness of those optimizations? In terms of, I mean, it sounds good, but like you could also say something else that also sounds good. And I'm wondering, so for any of these sort of recommendations here, have you sort of quantified the effectiveness in the past?
Not with Yammer specifically. I can't comment on that. I can say, though, that we did see at Genie, genie.com, that and when we have data behind this that says that people are more likely to invite people who are closer to them. So in the case of a family, it's like your blood relatives and your atomic family. We actually saw a lot of incentive to invite those people. And so the idea behind Genie is that we would only ask you to invite those who are directly related to you. And you can, sort of as a secondary action, invite those further out. But the idea was to keep it as close to the atomic center as possible.
Yeah, I'll comment on it a little bit more. So for Java software, as well as for kind of a lot of the social enterprises that are much more enterprise-focused, one of the common best practices is to establish a pilot within the organization. It's a very, very small group of people that are very highly engaged. So essentially what the Yammer Flow is modeling is essentially that process. You basically want your champions within the organization to be highly engaged with the workgroup product, then allow that to kind of spread. And just talking about kind of conversion data and everything in general, the more fields that you basically put, the less likely people are going to fill it out. And just knowing kind of the usual drop-offs for consumer internet software, even if you put 12 kind of data fields there, you know, no one's going to fill it out. So it's a combination of both. Focus on kind of the idea of a pilot and a work group product and establishing your champions within your organization. And then it's the other of reducing the dropout rate and conversion throughout the entire steps. So.
Got it. So by prompting for six people, it reinforces that this is the intended size of your initial work group. Second question is about, do you feel there's a tension between really excellent design and the speed of iteration? Because it's much more difficult to maintain to add a new button if your buttons look all really awesome versus if it's like, oh my gosh, the product really needs a button right here. Now we got to go get our designer to do it. It might delay it by a certain period of time. Whereas a lower bar of design might allow for a more rapid iteration. Have you seen that in the past?
Yeah, George can definitely. I mean, he's a designer, not me. So, but my comment on it is generally, you know, what I've done historically is provide a style guide, generally kind of a style or design guide, and then as long as you kind of have a lot of raw materials, whether it's PSDs or Adobe Illustrator files or kind of a common CSS and HTML templates, you can actually iterate through it relatively quickly if you can structure it well.
Got it.
And it just really depends on how you kind of implement the process.
Yeah, and the design of the site is actually an iterative process, just like the product feature list or just like sort of the engineering integrity, the code integrity. And so what we found is that we maintain a list of design iterations and features and improvements, just like we maintain a list of those things from the product side, from the engineering side. And so it's exciting to see how the design excellence actually evolves, just like the product evolves and just like the engineering integrity evolves.
Got it.
Evolves.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hey, guys. You talked a little bit about the kind of the push and pull between the buyer, the kind of the person who's in charge of purchasing an enterprise solution, and the employees. I'm curious, throughout the design process, the marketing, the sales, how do you think about talking just to the decision maker versus kind of having it, you know, talking to the employees who are going to then pull it up through the organization? How do you think about that? Those two sides.
Yeah, I mean, generally, we didn't want to kind of go into the roles that much, but generally speaking, the way we think about kind of the roles within the organization are there's the leadership, there's the managers, there's the end user, kind of employees. And then, you know, depending on your kind of a product, there's actually different types of, you know, auxiliary roles. Really, it's focused more on the manager, not necessarily the end user employees. So basically, and the manager is actually defined in two ways. There's traditional hierarchy kind of managers, and there's people that are leading kind of a cross-functional initiative that are more in the project manager role, but, you know, they're not kind of a part of a hierarchy. So more specifically, it's all geared toward the managers, basically someone that leads some type of a project that's part of a group. So, you know, hence work group. Whereas the end user, you know, if the person's not kind of looking to increase their productivity through any kind of a tool, you know, it's usually not a good fit. So,
yeah, and from a design standpoint, one of the unique things about designing software in this space is that oftentimes you'll have to actually design and prioritize for different roles, right? And so to the earlier point about the evolution of design and of the interface, over time, our product has started to split. And whether it's feature lists or the user experience, we're starting to tailor those things for different roles as the manager, the workgroup manager, and the individual employee. And so, that's one of the ways that the design of our site has evolved over time and something unique to designing software for this space.
Good morning. I was a little late, so I probably my question, if it's not relevant, please stop me. My understanding of this session, why I wanted to attend this was, let's say I am... Let's take an example of Flipboard, or let's take an example of something you use as consumers and you want to bring it to the enterprise. So I am an IT director or I am a VP, and I get a pressure from my business to say, I want to make sure that my employees can use Flipboard. My employees can use, let's say, yahoo.com within... or any other health news item within the enterprise. I think some of the, and I'll come to the question in a minute, because I just wanted to give you the reference to what I was thinking about. For me to help such applications, whether it's a website or whether it's a mobile app, which I allow people to download on their iPad, company given iPad or an iPhone, means that I have to look at security. I have to look at what is being accessed. Third, make sure that my telecommunications costs don't go over the moon, right? Do you have any experiences? As I heard it, it looked like you are looking at designing a website for the enterprise. I understand that, but how do you distribute and how do you make sure that an enterprise can accept something like a Dropbox? Because today Dropbox is being banned by large enterprises, and I am talking about enterprises with 15,000, 20,000 employees. Sorry if my question was long, but this was something which I was thinking as you were going through the design concepts.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's essentially two concepts. There's one kind of bringing kind of a consumer internet applications into the enterprise, and then there's making B2B applications so that they're friendly to the enterprise, and they're two different things. One is the workgroup product may or may not be enterprise kind of a software, meaning specifically is if it's focused on the manager, there's actually a lot of there's actually a lot of rogue managers actually using the product within the organization. And so the entire talk was actually designed so that as someone that's creating kind of a work group product, you can essentially create such rogue applications, so to speak. But on the other side, you know, basically what you're talking about with consumer internet applications and making it friendly for the enterprise, there are a series of companies that are kind of trying to do mobility as a service. They're trying to do security as a service, and thinking about, you know, different endpoints and security and other things. There are companies that are specifically trying to do that, but one of the kind of the nuances of the talk that we were kind of alluding to, but we didn't talk about directly, was the fact that pure consumer internet applications probably won't be necessarily adopted by the enterprise. Yeah. And we were basically alluding to the fact that, you know, a B2B software still has to solve a business need and business the managers that want to kind of adopt these productivity tools typically spread it within the organization. So you kind of see Box.net getting adopted in enterprises much more than Dropbox, because Dropbox, so like, you know, at Zynga we actually had this thing where Dropbox was spreading virally within and Yammer was spreading virally within Zynga, and then the director IT just basically cut it out. and there's different approaches. You know, sometimes people will actually say, hey, it's starting to spread virally, we actually want to take control. And Yammer actually has a lot of features that allows the IT administrator to actually take control of the Yammer kind of a product and start paying for it, and then control a lot of the security and everything else. Dropbox, you know, released recently the team edition, which is much more geared toward enterprises. But you know, certainly that is a concern. If they don't fully aren't business focused, B2B focused, you know, they won't consider a lot of this issues that enterprises have, which is certainly a concern. So, yeah,
good point. Thank you.
Yep.
Hello. Do you have any thoughts on the impact of pricing models?
Yeah. Are you talking about the impact of business models, or are you talking about the impact of the fact that the lower price point enables, you know, what specifically?
I guess thinking about changing from a traditional enterprise type of application where you have the big checklist and you sell higher up in the organization, to shifting around and really focusing on, you know, the teams.
Yep.
And so instead of selling, you know, 10,000 seats to an organization, you're selling directly to a team. Have you seen anybody switch, or do you have any thoughts on that in general?
Yeah, so traditional enterprise software is the way it is simply because of the cost structure. When I was at IBM, you had the software division working on it. You had IBM Global Services working on it, which is kind of about the consulting division. And then you had, a series of sales engineers and kind of a support working on it. And the cost structure of that only enables you to sell multi-million-dollar seats. And traditionally, the reason why there hasn't been any kind of a B2B SMB software in the space is distribution is incredibly difficult. So, you know, traditional kind of a CD-ROMs through retail is the classic kind of a distribution model. And it's very hard traditionally to actually reach SMBs. That's why when IBM started kind of their efforts to go into SMBs, they actually created a partner program, independent software vendors, value-added resellers, as well as kind of distributors to actually approach it, because it's been so traditionally hard. So in terms of kind of the pricing model, it really kind of goes after three core things. One is how much does it cost a startup to actually market it to sustain a company of that size? How how do they actually distribute the software, which is goes into kind of a discovery as well as marketing and everything else. And then what's the cost structure to kind of maintain it? Do you need an army of consultants to customize it? Do you need an army of support staff? So if it's a work group product, it's simple, it's easy to use, and the core functionality is XYZ versus XYZ, ABCD, EFG, it becomes a lot easier to support, and the cost structure becomes much more maintainable for to service SMBs. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
Hi. Excuse me. In one of your previous answers, you talked about the viral way some of these tools like Yammer and Dropbox spread throughout an organization, and also the way that you can then, as an organization, pay to take control of that network. And I actually had an interesting experience with that. My client's a large multinational, and they make extensive use of Yammer. But the way it started, well, anybody can start a Yammer network for the company they work for. It's free. You can just do it. And there's really nobody to stop you. So in the organization, we at some point had a discussion saying there is this large Yammer network. It's for our company or my client's company. And we now have two choices. There are and no other choice. And the choices are we can either kill it, we can shut down Yammer through the firewall, we won't allow access, maybe make a policy saying don't use this stuff anymore, or we can pay Yammer to gain control and manage your network. And my colleague sitting over there likened it a little bit to a mafia shakedown. And what I was wondering was this a consequence that you stumbled on by accident, or is this actually by design?
In general, I mean, that's an interesting way of saying it. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, at the end of the day, Yammer has to pay their employees. I mean, right? I mean, like, it may sound obvious, but, like, you know, I mean, in terms of, you're alluding to kind of about business models, right? You know, a lot of consumers are basically used to a business model which is centered around a marketplace business model. And the way it basically works is you get 20 million monthly active uniques, and then you get a small kind of a bit of advertising, and then you can actually sustain a company like that. The reason why B2B software has not traditionally been like that is you know it's you can't get 20 million users on it. So you know you might get 100,000 users and you know 100 companies. And what we're basically saying is the evolution is basically somewhere in between, right? And it's not quite. If you kind of looked at George's slide, you know, he did Genie, which had 100 million users, and then Yammer spun out of Genie, which had 4 million users, right? And so simply speaking, if it was just purely free, literally the company would not be able to survive. I don't think the analogy of a mafia shakedown is actually quite fair, because at the end of the day, you know, a product like Yammer would have traditionally cost multi-millions of dollars to actually even implement and use, and simply speaking, this allows people to kind of use it and find value in it before you actually pay for it. And so it's basically just to kind of summarize, it's an evolution between the enterprise software, which is millions of dollars, consumer internet, which as a business model, which is completely untenable because you have to have 20, 40 million users to actually even sustain the advertising cost. And so it's somewhere in between. So, yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, so you mentioned incentivizing users to add other users, and I think that's great, something we're not doing and we should. But the question I had revolves around, I guess, intelligence of that. So when I add you to this thing, are you guys capturing any other, I guess, information around that? And we have a problem with truly understanding who our customers are, but putting some context on customer to product or customer to customer relationships could help us out a lot. So I'm just curious if there's anything that you guys have done on that front.
Yeah, so what Yammer does, actually, since we're speaking about Yammer, is that it actually, they don't phrase it as you're inviting people. They're actually phrasing it as you're following people.
Okay.
And so what that's doing, actually, is if the user is already a Yammer user, you become a follower of that person. If they're not already a user, then it becomes an invite plus a follow.
Right.
So there are multiple things that are happening. When you're at the same time as you're doing the inviting, there's all kinds of opportunities to do that, because basically, like, there's so much context around capturing who invites who and what their relationship is.
Right.
But there's always, from a UI standpoint, there's always that balance between, you know, making the most out of the opportunity while you have them to get the information in order to create powerful relationships. And at the same time, making it really, really simple and a very, very low barrier to entry. So that's a good point, though.
Yeah. The other thing is what you're alluding to is kind of a viral coefficients and how you kind of make things viral. Generally speaking, you have to just provide a lot of analytics around kind of the two sides of the equation, basically sender rates as well as accept rates. Basically, how people, when they land on the page, how many people actually send through that,
mm-hmm.
you know, percent senders, the many invites they send, and then accept rates, people that actually click through and people that actually accept the registration and invite flow. And essentially, that's once you have that statistic, you can optimize the copy, you can optimize the incentive, and what you'll get is out of, you know, 20 or 30 tries, you'll get a couple of them that will just blow it out of the box.
Right.
And those are the things that you stick with. So,
yeah. So thanks a lot. Those are all amazing questions. And I think we're out of time for the official thing, but we'll actually be around. We've got a lot of BetterWorks folks here. We've got Paige, who's the third co-founder and CEO. We've got PR, we've got operations, we've got business development, and we'd all like to help you. So we could extend it. If they kick us out of this room, we could just go right outside and continue our conversations. But thank you for showing up. Really appreciate it.